when you're the small guy placing the orders and the big guys all of a sudden have a bunch of demand because pandemic factors or others, you're deprioritized pretty quickly. And so that was also another hard learning. If I knew what I knew today, I honestly don't know if I would have started Apolog.
Leron Hirschhorn, your host of The Brand Podcast. In this episode, I talked to Jordan Tepper of Apolog, who grew not just one, but three different brands within the alcohol and beverage space. We speak about the strategy behind each one and the different channels he sells in, such as restaurants and bars, retail, as well as e-commerce. What he had to do to pivot in the pandemic when restaurants and bars shut down, and breaking into retail, sampling, and what you have to do to really grow a CPG brand today. I think you'll really enjoy this episode with Jordan Tepper.
The podcast is brought to you by IncrementumDigital.com. At Incrementum Digital, we help your brand scale on Amazon and retail media. You can check out IncrementumDigital.com.
Welcome to The Brand Podcast, where you'll learn from successful omnichannel brands, which in turn will help your brand grow. Here's your host, Leron Hirschhorn. The Brand
Podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited.
Great. Thank you. We'd love to hear a little bit of your story. I know you went from being an investment banker into the beverage alcohol industry. So we'd love to hear how you got there and what that transition was like.
So the work I was doing in investment banking was primarily in the paper and packaging industry, doing mergers and acquisitions. But I did do one project in the beer space for a company at the time that was called North American Brewing up in New York, and really was interested in that space. I actually love packaging now. It's very fascinating. Going to paper mills and label factories and whatnot was not really what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Also, your job as an investment banker is really to position a company for sale. I think it's good experience, but it's the same process over and over again for different companies. And so I actually connected to a friend, Miller Coors, and said, how do I do strategy for a big beverage alcohol company? So we have to go to business school. So I went to business school. I ended up getting a job offer with Miller Coors in corporate strategy and also a job offer with the Boston Consulting Group. That same friend, turns out, had worked at the Boston Consulting Group before Miller Coors. So I asked him, what should I do? He said, go spend a few years at BCG if you want to get into BevAlc after that. You'll be good. So that's what I did. I spent 4 years at the Boston Consulting Group, primarily doing strategy projects for large CPG and food and beverage companies, including in the wine and spirit space. And after doing that for 4 years, I ended up taking a leave of absence to actually start making liqueurs and see if we can build a business in this space. So that's how I transitioned out.
And do you think that really, I guess that experience really prepped you to go out and start your own brand within the space?
Yeah, the niche we started in was in the liqueur category. A liqueur is a type of spirit often used as a modifier in cocktails. So some examples are Campari or Aperol. And when I was working for the big guys, the $10 billion plus spirit companies, they all had liqueur brands in their portfolios, but it wasn't even like the C team working on the liqueur brands. It was like 20% of the time of someone on the C team working on these $300-500 million brands. And so when we approached them about investing more in the space, they basically said, look, we're a $10 billion company. We need to win in whiskey. We need to win in vodka. If someone's successful in this liqueur category, we'll just buy them. So for me, that was like a little bit of a light bulb moment of, okay, here's an interesting spearhead into this industry that's growing as people get more interested in cocktails. But the big guys are really not focusing their attention and bandwidth on the segment. So that was part of the impetus.
Got it. And then so the first brand that you started was Apolog, was because I know you have three different like brands within the category.
Yeah. So we started with our namesake Apolog liqueurs, and that was the initial premise, was basically to make a line of all natural liqueurs that could be easily substituted into classic cocktail recipes to help elevate them and bring more transparency to the liqueur category. And for that, we were very focused on bars and restaurants. In beverage alcohol, they have what you call the on-premise, which are bars and restaurants, and the off-premise, which are retail. Mm-hmm. And where we were getting our traction and we were focused was on the on-premise bars and restaurants, getting into these cocktail placements. We influence one beverage director that reaches hundreds of people through their cocktail program. Unfortunately, we were about 85-90% bar and restaurant focused when the pandemic hit and all the bars and restaurants shut down overnight. So we had to evolve and we had to pivot. For us, what we did was we stepped back and said, hey, look, like we have a really good reputation within the bar and restaurant community. We have a lot of great relationships there, but the entire world just moved to retail. And so what bar restaurant can we actually partner with to create a retail product? And so that's how our second brand was born. We worked with a very popular bar and restaurant in Chicago called Big Star, which were known for their margaritas, and margarita being one of the most popular, you know, cocktails out there. We spent the first 3 months of the pandemic doing nothing but trying to figure out how to can the Big Star margarita so we could have a retail product.
Got it. Yeah, I was gonna ask you what that was like in the pandemic, and yeah, what you had to do to pivot and what you learned. I remember during the pandemic that actually, I think retail alcohol sales did pretty well. I guess that's because people were just home and we're not going out anymore. So that was like, I guess that was a good place to be, but you weren't quite in retail when the pandemic hit.
Father, who's involved in the business, unexpectedly passed away. Wow. March 15th, all the bars and restaurants closed out. Yeah. And so it was a really intense time period. All of our POs for all of our distributors were canceled. I was helping the distillery we work out of figure out how to make hand sanitizer. Mm-hmm. And we knew, yes, retail spiked, but the brands that did really well were really the established, well-known brands, because people weren't going into stores. They were ordering on their phones. Right. They were buying Tito's. They were buying the wine brand that they go to. And so that's what was doing really well. We were fortunate in that by partnering with Big Star, which has really good brand equity, people know the brand, people crave it. They weren't able to go to Big Star because the restaurants were shut down. And so when we announced that, we had, for the first time ever, our demand exceeded our supply. And so we spent the first kind of year after we launched that trying to catch up to the demand for Big Star's margaritas in a can, which was like a very like aggressive switch from where we were 3 months prior.
Did it teach you that you really need to be like multi-channel, or have a business that was a combination of, as you said, like on-premise, off-premise, and then maybe even e-commerce? I know with Epilogue, you're also selling that on e-commerce, although I know that also has its own sort of set of challenges when you're dealing with alcohol sales.
Yeah. So I do think it is a good forcing mechanism. And it also led to the establishment of our third brand, which is our Host Cocktails. Our Host Cocktails started with the Gold Fashion, which is a super premium bottled cocktail that we launched in October of 2021. And part of that genesis actually came from Big Star. We had a lot of people reaching out that wanted to ship Big Star to their friend in Tennessee or to their house. And when you're selling a four pack for $19.99 and they find out it's going to cost $15 to ship it, the right. economics on that are really tough to make work for everyone. However, if you're selling a bottle for $150, the willingness for the consumer to absorb $15 for shipping or for you to subsidize it as part of the margin becomes a lot more digestible. And so what we learned really quickly with Big Star was, while Big Star had a great brand, we weren't going to be able to compete on scale and on price. We had to compete on quality. And so the premise for Host Cocktails was, can we create the highest quality cocktail experience possible and price it accordingly? And that's worked really well for us. And that brand is about 50% e-commerce based today, which is very unusual in BevAlk and has been something that we've really tried to lean into. And so now we have diversification across a couple of different things. One is channel. Thankfully, bars and restaurants have reopened, and Applelog is still to this day 85% bars and restaurants. We have the Big Star cocktails, which are almost 100% retail, off-premise focused. And then we have our host cocktails, which are 50% e-commerce and about 50% more traditional retail, Foxtrots, Binnie's of the world. The other part of that is they all have a little bit different seasonality to them as well. And so that helps us. Big Star from Cinco de Mayo through Labor Day is can't make enough of it. And then it falls off a cliff in the wintertime. But guess what? In the wintertime, people are gifting. They want to drink an old fashioned. And so we've had balance in our portfolio from that.
And one of the things that I saw a recent post you made about the challenges that exist within the alcohol beverage space in terms of shipping, e-commerce and shipping and regulations. So is a lot of that sort of in-state local deliveries because there are certain regulations around shipping alcohol across to certain states?
So alcohol in the United States is primarily regulated on a state-by-state basis.
Right.
Every state has different laws, and all states operate at least in a three-tier system, which means you can either be a manufacturer, a distributor, or a retailer, which includes bars and restaurants. And in order for you to sell to a consumer, it needs to go through all three tiers. And so that makes you can't technically do direct to consumer. You can do e-commerce, but you can't do DTC. So someone now can go on our website, hostcocktails.com, and purchase a bottle like they're purchasing it from our website. And the consumer feels as if it's a DTC purchase.
Right.
But what's happening on the background is based on their zip code and relative inventory levels, that order is actually getting routed to one of our retail partners who bought it, one of our distributors who bought it from us, which is incredibly inefficient if you think about it, because consumer just wants to buy it from us and it would make me super happy. So when you buy a gold fashion from our website at $150 a bottle, we only see about $90 of that. Whereas if we could actually sell direct to consumer and ship it to them, and these people are shipping it the same way that I would ship it, FedEx and UPS, it's a very archaic system that has largely stayed in place because of the power of the distributors in that middle tier to keep themselves at the intersection of things.
So it works out well for them. They have the orders still have to go through them as opposed to directly with the brand. But I guess the benefit is that unlike a retail order, you're still getting the contact information. You're able to market to that audience, except you make a wholesale margin instead of a kind of direct retail sale margin.
Exactly. The other drawback is there's no accountability for the retailer for filling the order to provide a good customer experience.
Right.
And so if that customer has a bad experience with the shipping of that bottle, they blame the brand, even though technically I have almost no control over that. But that is the world we live in today.
Because the consumer has no idea that's how this business kind of...
80% of consumers have no idea that all that stuff is happening in the background and inefficiencies are there.
I saw a post where you talked about like the importance of sampling within the CPG space. And one of the things that you wrote was that if you want to start a CPG business and you're not prepared to go to stores, sample, work 10 Saturdays, sampling shifts, et cetera, and do that for every three months for the next 3 years, et cetera, it's going to be hard to break into the industry. So was sampling in store a very important part of your strategy? I'm assuming based on that. Or slinging bars or...
Yeah. Sampling is very important in food and beverage and spirits, they call it liquid to lips, because people want to try something before they buy it, especially the higher the price point that product is.
Right.
And they can be risk averse around that. It also makes it much harder to scale a CPG product than, say, a tech product, because the just the physical work it goes into bringing liquid to lips at scale takes a long time or a lot of people to be able to do that. And so it is one of those things that's been tried and true in the industry. I think there are interesting ways people are trying to innovate around sampling to bring liquid to lips in a more efficient way, but people still want to try a beverage before they buy the beverage, especially as that price point goes up. There's also, I think, some auxiliary benefits of that, of like, you actually get to see consumers' reaction. What questions do they have? What things resonate with them? You get to talk to the people in store who are merchandising the store shelves or the store buyer. What's moving? What's not? Where are we showing up on shelf? How can we be there better? So I think there are a number of auxiliary benefits of doing the sampling, and I've gotten a ton of consumer insights from doing them. But at the end of the day, the baseline is still people want to try these products before they buy them, and that takes a lot of effort.
And is it a challenge for you in terms of like even getting that shelf space in retail because you're up against some major competitors, or did you enter into a niche where, as you said before, the major brands are not as focused on it, and because of that, you're able to break through?
Both. I think the niche that we are in is it's easier to break through into bars and restaurants because they're turning over their cocktail menus sometimes twice a year, sometimes four times a year, sometimes more. And so their willingness to try something new is lower than, say, a retailer that might only reset their store shelves once or twice a year at most and have a lot more influence from the larger brands. They're just not able to carry as many SKUs. One of the ways you counteract that is by supporting it with sampling programs. There's a lot of data evidence to show that when someone's in store doing a sampling, you're going to sell more of those bottles that day than otherwise. So if you're willing to invest in sampling, that's going to increase the likelihood that the retailer is willing to take a chance and put you on store shelves.
Got it. And you talked about a little bit before, but is that something, I mean, that you could do at scale? Are you doing a lot of that yourself? Are you hiring a company that kind of goes across retailers and does it? Obviously, it's not going to be as successful probably if it's as it is from like you, the founder, being there and sampling, but also very challenging to scale that.
Yeah, it is challenging to scale that. Definitely, I don't even think I'm the best sampler on our team. We have taken the approach of we do hire sampling folks, but they're all internally trained. We don't work with outsourced third-party firms that have people that do 20 different brands. Right. That's just not effective. We also try to find more creative and brand building ways to do sampling than just being at the liquor store or the grocery store. That's another thing that the pandemic changed is the amount of shoppers that would come through, say, a Whole Foods in 2019 versus now is significantly lower. There's a lot of Instacart shoppers, Amazon Prime shoppers that are going through them. So you're not actually getting the same ROI on those sampling experiences. So we're trying to find more creative ways to meet consumers where they are. For example, we did an event recently with the Kenilworth Cooking Club, a suburb of Chicago. It's primarily women, but 70 of them come out for an evening and they're cooking different dishes. And that's where we're able to sample our cocktails with them, which is complimentary. It's meeting them where they are. It's in a positive experience. And then they can go order online or go to their grocery store afterwards. That to us is a much more effective and in some ways scalable solution to do those type of events than to just get more and more people at more and more grocery stores.
Yeah. I saw on one of your LinkedIn posts, you mentioned that sort of being able to sample within the environment that kind of more conducive to a person having a cocktail, like at an event like that, as opposed to in a retail store. And yeah, wasn't on my mind, but yeah, for sure the future and growth, I know it's rare that I walk into a Whole Foods or we order Amazon Fresh and they deliver it and that person just has a list. They're not like looking out for any new products for me. So there's less consumers actually buying for themselves within the retail stores as well. Do you do any sort of advertising within either digital or local, or is it mostly outreach and working with, like you said, either retailers or bars, restaurants? Are you running ads on e-commerce, or is that mostly for people who already know the brand and are there to purchase a second time? Because yeah, you don't have that. I think of it like almost selling like a fragrance or something online, right? Like hard for me to buy. I don't know what it smells like, right? Like I want to go smell it, like you said, sample. So what strategies are you using to grow the brand? Is any of that through like digital ads?
Yeah. The answer is yes. It's not our primary focus. Right now today, we're still so small and we still have so much ground to cover. We're primarily focused more on event marketing and word of mouth marketing tactics to grow the brand. But when we do look into advertising, we're trying to be very targeted with that spend. So to give an example on the digital side, our liqueurs, again, they sell into bars and restaurants and beverage directors. There's a company in Chicago called Provi, which is essentially an aggregator of distributor portfolios that let beverage directors or retail buyers buy from an app or their tablet. And if we would do that, we're going to focus on one of our liqueurs right before spring, summer cocktail flip to promote that, because it's getting to the buyers at their point of demand at a time when they should be thinking about it. And we're supporting them with other activities, and we're doing that in a specific geography. So when we are advertising, or if we're going to do an Instacart spend for the Paloma, we're doing that right before Cinco de Mayo, because we know that's when the energy is going to be there. Yes, it's more competitive in that space at that time as well, but like trying to pick those type of niches, embrace the fact that we're more geographically concentrated and double down on that and be efficient with that spend.
Got it. And any desire to add any like non-alcoholic beverages? I combed through your post before for getting ready for this interview. I saw you mentioned that there's like more supply than maybe demand in the space. And if there's a company that's doing only non-alcoholic, then there may be opportunity for one or maybe two companies to win, but there's probably not enough demand for a company that's doing just non-alcoholic beverages to win. But is that an area where, you know, you can add on and maybe not have as many of the, you know, hindrances like e-commerce, D2C, some of these other things? Or is that, because I think you mentioned in your post, like it's not a different customer, right? I drink alcohol socially. Maybe there's a night where I want to have one drink of alcohol and it's a work event. And for my second and third, I'll just drink something non-alcoholic so that I don't do something stupid, right? Like at a you know, work function, for example. So how do you see that space? Obviously, it seems to be growing, but any desire to enter that space?
Yeah, I'm definitely bullish on the non-alc space. And I think there is a lot of overlap with the consumer more so than not. We actually developed a non-alc product that we were gearing up to launch right before the pandemic, but it was very focused on bars and restaurants. Right. And so we tabled it, and we are thinking about doing something in that space. But again, it would be an extension of what we're already doing. And I think that's where the bigger future of non-alc is going to come. It's going to be host cocktails. We have a gold fashion. We have a martini. We have a low ABV rosé spritz. And now we have a non-alc cocktail. So people who know the host cocktail brand and trust it, if they're going to change it up, hey, I'm not drinking this week. I'm not drinking this night. I'm taking a break because I just had a drink and I want to keep the night going, but I don't want to overdo it. That gives them an opportunity to stay engaged with the brand. And I think that is going to be the bigger future of non-alc. You've already seen it with beer, Heineken 0.0, Guinness 0.0, but I think it's going to continue to extend into wine and spirits. And we want to be on that forefront on the cocktail side. I think there'll be a couple of pure play players that survive, but it's a very tough environment to try to build a business on that alone.
And probably also, I don't know, based on regulations, probably also easier to break into. So maybe more competitors in general in that space.
Yeah, it's a great space. Like people are interested in it and passionate about it. The truth of the matter is like more money and more people have flocked to it than the market size is today.
Right.
And so it just makes it that much harder to compete in because the barriers to entry are relatively low. The amount of capital that's been deployed to the space is relatively high, and the market is getting there, but it's not there yet. So you're just, it's just a knife fight in that category right now, which is tough.
Your website mentioned Epilogue that you're like in the intersection of community culture. How do you see brand building and community, or how are you leveraging? Is it through these, like just the concept of local events and interacting with an audience, or how do you see the importance of building a community today to build a brand, especially in this space?
Yeah, I think there's two parts of that and they're related. One is embracing the community that you're currently in, and the other is actually cultivating a community around what you're doing. For us, we use cocktails, community, and culture as a very helpful lens for if something is a worthwhile initiative. For instance, we do an event called Epilogue Intermission. It's at a well-known local cocktail bar where they put on Epilogue cocktails. We partner with a community nonprofit organization, so they're able to bring their people out to the event. And we engage two local musical artists to play that night at the venue, and the nonprofit presents at intermission. So we have a cross-section of community, culture, and cocktails all happening at the same time. And I think that experience for everybody involved is more holistic and complete and resonates more so than, say, if we just did a cocktail night at a bar where, okay, we're doing Epilogue cocktails here, come have it. It gives people more reason and I think has a greater degree of stickiness to it. I think the more challenging thing and the more aspirational thing is really building a community around what you're doing as a company and your products. And that's something we're working on every day and investing a lot in for primarily. Epilogue is focused very much on the hospitality industry and how we can continue to be part of that community and be value add to that community. Big Star is a little different because they have their own brand, right? That it's really a little bit of a different beast. And then for Host Cocktails, that is something that we're investing a lot right now in trying to figure out how do we add value to the consumers that are Host Cocktail fans so they feel like they're part of the Host Cocktails community. And some of that is digital and some of that is physical, and we're tinkering our way through it right now.
Got it. Now, I'm not sure if you... the background of the brand in terms of if you had to, I'm assuming you had to probably raise some money for the brand, but for somebody listening who is in the beverage space or wants to get into the beverage space, maybe alcohol or non-alcohol, but obviously it's highly, highly competitive. Whenever, I'm not an expert in the beverage space, but when I watch Shark Tank and somebody comes in with a beverage, they're like, oh, you're going to get killed, right? Like it's going to be almost impossible for you to kind of break through. How important is that in having a big war chest to break through? Or would you say you can start with a low amount of money or bootstrap if you're tackling a niche? And it sounds like you did it more kind of the niche way and local and were able to break through. But like advice for those brands listening that want to break into the beverage space.
Yeah, I kind of break it into two different categories. You're either a category creator or you're a category improver. Uh-huh. And if you're a category improver, you need a war chest, like a big one. And you need a rock star team that has deep experience and deep connections and the ability to scale manufacturing fast. And when I say category improver, that's a better for you beverage or some added functional attribute where the category is established and you're trying to create just a better version of that. You need a lot of capital to be able to do that effectively. And if you don't, you're probably not going to make it. And that's just the truth of the matter. Now, the other is a category creator. These are where you find the 10-year overnight successes, the GT kombuchas.
Right.
That's, you got to be ready to freaking grind, because it's going to take a while for consumers even to understand how to use your product and think about your product. And so that's more about being lean. It helps to have raised capital to be able to make it down that long chute. And we're more so we started as a category improver. And that was a hard lesson learned, is that if you're really going to go after the liqueur niche, even as niche as it is, mm-hmm. you're better off doing it like hard and fast with a lot of capital behind it, and are now moving more into category creator around some of these. There's no super premium bottled cocktails out there. When we did it, we were 3 times the price of the next closest competitor. And I absolutely think, as you've seen in spirits and you've seen in wine, the industry is premiumized. And I think it will come in the cocktail side as well, but it's not something that's going to happen overnight. And so we needed to diversify our revenue streams and our income streams to be able to make that longer journey. And so that's why we have the three brands.
Right. Okay. So it was like a lesson learned from understanding how much money it takes just to come in and improve upon something versus create it, and as you said, grind, which probably revolves around education or whatever it is, right? The awareness that this particular product exists. Yeah, like a kombucha, which today many people know what it is, but yeah, 10 years ago, probably a lot of people didn't, or 15 years ago, a lot of people didn't know what the product is. Is it hard to focus on three brands at a time, or is it just a matter of where like the majority of your focus is in at one particular time? You're focused on one of the brands and that's where a lot of the energy goes, or because I imagine each of these brands requires its own area of focus.
Yeah, no, it is hard to concentrate on three brands, and I would not I wish I was Tito's some days, right? Like they just make vodka. Like they don't even make a flavored vodka. The streamline of that operation to just be able to focus on that, I think, is actually very powerful. Unfortunately, we don't have that luxury. We need to have a level of dynamism in our portfolio to be able to ride out those seasonality features, to be able to deal with when off-premise goes up or on-premise goes up. And so we have to manage that complexity in order to build a sustainable business. That said, we have been intentional about the stuff that we're doing, that there is, as I mentioned earlier, different seasonalities in those businesses. Right. We know exactly when to hit the gas on the Apolog liqueur side. It's right before spring, summer cocktail flip. It's right before fall, winter cocktail flip. We get as many cocktail placements as possible, and that drives our velocities for the next 6 months. And then we got to pick it up and do it better and more. But it's not actually as much of a day in and day out style of business. We've built in some busy times of different brands to let it all work. And we would be in a worse financial position if we only had one. Our brands are not strong enough to stand yet financially on themselves, but across them, it works. And so that's what we have to keep doing. And that's just going to be it. You do have your bandwidth spread a little bit further, but sometimes there's some complementary things that come from that.
Got it. Great. And what is the last question? What is it that now that you didn't know, that as an investment banker, you were seeing sort of one side of the business, right? Like advising businesses in the space, helping them get ready for an exit. What are those things that you only learn on the job? You can't, obviously it's something like the pandemic, right? No way you could have prepared for that. Yeah. But what is it that you kind of know today? And would you do it all over again, knowing what the road is like?
Yeah, some things I learned for sure. One, unique to the alcohol industry, but different when I was working with the large guys, the challenge of the distribution tier being very consolidated and very powerful was not as big of a challenge for the big manufacturers as it is for the small ones. And that distribution tier has continued to consolidate. That makes it very hard to operate as a small brand. I don't think I had a full appreciation for that. The other is, you know, I think a lot of people take packaging for granted and all the different moving pieces of the supply chain for granted. And when you are working with a big company, you have more leverage in terms of people actually make sure your order arrives on time and customer service is great. But when you're the small guy placing the orders and the big guys all of a sudden have a bunch of demand because pandemic factors or others, you're deprioritized pretty quickly. And so that was also another hard learning. If I knew what I knew today, I honestly don't know if I would have started Apolog, but I also feel very fortunate that I did was ignorant enough to go on this journey.
Right.
TBD still, if it's going to be successful. But honestly, the opportunity to work for a few years very closely with my dad in that capacity was very special to me. The ability to learn the industry from ground up was very impactful for me. I'm happy I did it. I don't know if I was giving myself advice for 7 years ago, if I would say, yeah, that's a good idea, you should do it.
Right. And yeah, I think that's one of, sometimes that could be a good thing, right? Like, you don't know how hard it's going to be. Maybe wouldn't have entered into it, but I think that's like entrepreneurship, and you keep going and you have lessons learned, and hopefully there's a positive result on the other side. Great. I really appreciate you coming on. What are some of the best ways to maybe stay connected to you? Is it LinkedIn, and see what you're up to in terms of the brands, and maybe how can people follow along for the story?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, one, if you're a person who loves making your own cocktails or going out to bars and restaurants, check out Apolog Liqueurs, apologliqueurs.com. Make some very cool liqueurs, like our saffron liqueur or celery liqueur. If there's someone who loves cocktails but doesn't actually like making themselves or wants to be able to serve them to people in their house, check out Host Cocktails. We're going to be coming out with a couple of new cocktails this spring summer, a Mezcal Negroni that I'm very excited about, and a Perfect Manhattan. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to start to explore into the low ABV and no ABV side of things. And so we really want people to be able to be a really dynamic host themselves and to have a drink for any occasion and any drinker. And we're going to be opening up a physical production space and cocktail bar in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago in June of 2024. So definitely follow us at Host Cocktails, and it's going to be exciting bringing that to life.
Great. Thank you so much. It's a lot of great lessons learned that I think will be very interesting for anybody in this CPG and beverage space to hear.
Awesome. I appreciate you having me and chatting.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the episode. Would love your feedback and review of the podcast on Apple, Spotify, and any suggestions you have for great guests and hearing their brand story. The brand.